Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Kendall. I am an honor student and will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. This is the 13th event in our 16th annual Siciliano Forum. This year's topic is the future of higher education. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is The Innovative University. Today's guest is Henry J. Eyring. Mr. Eyring serves as Advancement Vice President at BYU-Idaho, which is featured in The Innovative University. He worked formerly as a management consultant with Monitor Company, as the director of the MBA program at Brigham Young University's Marriott School of Management, and as a mission president for the Mormon Church in Japan. He is the director of SkyWest Airlines, the world's largest regional airline, and in addition to The Innovative University, he is also the author of two other books. Please join me in welcoming Henry J. Eyring.
Thank you very much. Is my mic working the way it ought to? Great. It's just wonderful to be with you. And I appreciate, especially on the weekend before spring break, those of you who are here to talk about higher education. I hope we'll have the opportunity to learn together. It is a very exciting time in this arena, even more so than when that book that was referenced, The Innovative University, was published 18 months ago. If you told me how much would happen in that period, I'd have been surprised. I'd have probably waited to publish the book so that we could make reference to things like MOOCs, which everyone has heard of. And I'm going to confess to you, 18 months ago, I hadn't. I've now taken several. I have not completed them. I justify my failure to finish as a matter of wanting to sample many of them. The truth is, I've enrolled in a number that were just over my head. Stanford's machine learning course looked good on the front end, and I thought, well, if 60,000 people think they can do it, I ought to be able to as well. And turns out that statistical analysis was flawed, because you either know how to write code or you don't, and I don't. But I've learned a lot, and I hope to learn together with you today. As the pace of change increases in higher education, it becomes even more important to make good projections about the future. Now, the problem I have with the future is my data aren't very good. I just can't be sure what's going to happen. In particular, it's hard to tell what innovations are out there that we've foreseen but may come more quickly than expected, others that we haven't foreseen at all. And then there's also, for traditional colleges and universities, the question of how will they react? And you can't be sure about that either. My dear friend and co-author Clayton Christensen has been quoted recently as saying that within 15 years, as many as half of all traditional colleges and universities may be bankrupt. Clayton's very smart. He has seen disruption occur in many industries, as he calls them, and I'm not sure. He might be right in this case, although it depends a lot on those two things that I mentioned: how much innovation and how quickly, and then significantly, how do the traditional colleges and universities respond? So that's what I'd like to explore with you today. And one of the things that I find useful as I think about the future is to draw from analogies. So it's nice if you can look back where we do have data, and say, well, what happened in an arena like this one, in an industry that bears some resemblance to higher education? Now, analogies are two-edged swords, right? Because they can teach you things to the extent that the thing you're looking at truly is analogous. But if you lose sight of the limitations of analogies, you can learn the wrong lessons. So with that caveat, what I'd like to do is invite you to propose some analogies that may teach us things about what's going to happen in higher education. I'm going to start with this question. Can you think of industries that have been severely disrupted? Okay, and disruption means especially the players at the top that had been around for a long time or that were very, very large, very, very successful. Things change so rapidly that even they have stumbled or fallen. Okay, that's the definition of disruption. So can you give an example? And we've got a microphone here. Can you give an example of an industry that's been quite severely disrupted?
Well, publishing, particularly print media publishing in almost all its aspects. The most recent example we have, of course, is Time Magazine is being shed by its name at the front of Time Warner, and they can't distance themselves from fast enough from print media.
It's remarkable, isn't it, that the speed with which that has occurred. And maybe it's because we're older. But it really strikes me. I mean, I remember when I became a proud Time subscriber in college. I felt very cutting edge, even though I didn't have time to read it. I took pride in subscribing. And now look what's happened. Let's try to identify what is it about the various publishing industries that has made them susceptible to this kind of disruption. Let's bring the microphone back. What do you think? But others can feel free to answer. What is it about the function they perform that made it so disruptible?
Well, it's again, it's Clayton's classic. You had sustaining growth by all the from the New York Times on down. And then you had these fledgling, if you really think back to the very beginnings of electronic publishing, these not awful, but not very great, efforts. And it was not good enough, but they could improve rapidly. And that they have now intersected in many cases and surpassed the sustaining efforts or not so sustaining efforts as publication after publication cease publication.
Yeah, So what they were and are in the business of information, words, and images, and of course they had a great reputation, but it turns out that those words and images, in ways we could not have foreseen, can now be put out in electronic format all over the world, instantaneously at very, very low cost. So that's been disruptive for them. Let's take another industry. What can you think of that has changed? Big brand names. There was one of these shops or one of these stores in your hometown, and now it's gone. Yes.
Music retailers.
Are you young enough to remember flipping through records? Maybe records is taking it too far back, but maybe at least CDs. Like you've actually gone into a physical store, music was playing, and there were CDs, and you thumbed through the CDs. So we still remember that. And what's happened to it now? And again, what is it about that business that has made it so disruptible?
Well, do you have online piracy, and now you have things like iTunes where you can download, for much cheaper than you would for.
Yeah, so in this case, not only is this information, if you will, not only can it be distributed very, very broadly, it can be stolen pretty easily. Okay, so big disruption there. Very good. There's another hand all the way in the back of an industry that's been highly disrupted. If the core doesn't go there, you might have to take a walk.
I would go and use an example of like companies like IBM who weren't able to adapt to the changes in information technology, and companies like Microsoft came in and swooped under them. IBM for so long during World War II was the standard bearer of IT back in the 60s and the 70s, and then Microsoft came in and was more agile about the products they delivered.
Excellent, excellent. So here's an industry then which was always about technology. See, music and publishing, you wouldn't have thought of those as technology businesses. But now here's a case where IBM, they're in the business of technology, so it shouldn't have been so hard for them to adapt. But it was. And this goes back to the comment that was made. Clayton Christensen identifies that what happens is when you get very, very big, very, very established, even if you're technology savvy, it's hard to change the way you do things. It's hard to change the products that you make, especially if they're highly profitable. So IBM used to be able to sell big, big pieces of what they called iron. In those days, computers were iron, and they would fill rooms of this size or more. And you could make a lot of money selling that kind of machine. And when Ken Olson came along with a company called Digital Equipment Corporation, you remember Digital or DEC? He could make smaller machines that were less expensive, not as profitable. It's tough for the IBM folks because they like selling the profitable. If I can sell one of these big machines, that's going to earn me more profit, both as a company and as an individual sales rep, than selling many of those smaller mini computers, they were called, that Digital Equipment Corporation was making. Yes, bring the microphone forward, please.
I mean, it's incredible that Ken Olson, I came along and in Cambridge at the time he was working, and Georges Doriot could turn $70,000 into $485 million in an investment, and this prophet would say, I can't imagine why anyone would ever want one of them, meaning a personal computer, in their home. And Bill Gates would observe, not a decade later, that it was like he was watching a world-class, to date myself, Juan Fangio, you know, in a Grand Prix, and he came to a 90-degree turn, and he didn't even move the wheel. He just plowed straight ahead into the barricades. And so it's remarkable, and it shows, as Clayton points out, that a corporation and structures and even your own thought process can get lassoed so that you can't move.
Yeah, it really is true. Lassoed's a good way to say it. You're established in what it is you do. Okay. By the way, just to add on this, so it is true. This great prophet of the computer industry, Ken Olson, is quoted as saying, why in the world would anyone want a computer in their home? What possible use could you have for a computer in their home? And I don't know whether it was, I'm sure Bill Gates might have been one of the people who pointed out the irony of that, but I think Bill Gates was at one time on record as saying the internet won't do anything. Why would anybody be interested in the internet? So it's hard. It's hard, even if you're a pioneer, to see the next wave of pioneers coming. Now, so this is a place to stop and say, how does this make you feel about higher education? So we've identified some things that make you kind of vulnerable to disruption. One is, if your business is, if it's really a lot about information and how information can be shared very, very rapidly, very, very inexpensively, what does that mean for higher education? And then we take the example of, these big, big computer companies, even though they're in the business of discovering knowledge and deploying new technology, once you get established if you get big and if you do things in a consistent way and you're kind of proud of your traditions, at IBM the tradition was blue suit, white shirt, red tie. And there were a lot of other traditions associated with the way they did business, the kinds of customers they thought were valuable customers, big corporations. Digital came in and was able to serve companies that couldn't afford IBM products. And then their waves, Wozniak and Jobs came in underneath that. And who knows who's coming in underneath them. Samsung, at least in the case of the phone that I've got. Now let's take it the other direction. Can you think of some industries where the big names of 50 or even 100 years ago haven't changed? Because this is right when you're looking for analogies, you want to make sure you've got a big set so you learn the right lessons. Not everything has been disrupted. What are some examples the way to do this is think of certain brand names, even though you're not 50 or 100 years old, where you know those names have been around for a while. What are they? What are those businesses? Yes. Okay, now this is a great example. Let's take Union Pacific. That's a great example. Railroads. Union Pacific was founded when?
1870s?
Yeah, yeah. Brigham Young was one of the original major investors. Okay, so it's that old. And railroads, who'da thunk? Railroads, this really is a fun example. If you go back in time, and you look at the time the Spellings Commission. In fact, well, you've given me a really great setup here. I'm going to see if I can hit B. Oh, look, there it comes back. And I'm going to show you. Here it is. This is a statement made in 2006 in what was called the Spellings Commission report. Highly controversial report issued under the second President George Bush. And here's the way, this is one of the opening salvos in this Spellings Commission report. And by the way, higher education in 2006, how was higher education, how threatened were institutions of higher education feeling in 2006? And if you had an endowment, regardless of the size, but certainly if you had a $1 billion endowment, you were getting 20% per year annual returns. If you had a $1 billion endowment, you'd have an extra $200 million to spend. This was a great, great time. So a very unusual and difficult time to be saying higher education could be in trouble. And here's what these folks said, and they were really just jeered. As being absolute, you know, chicken littles, you foresee, and being politically motivated. History is littered with examples of industries that, at their peril, failed to respond to or even to notice changes in the world around them, from railroads to steel manufacturers. Without serious self-examination and reform, institutions of higher education risk falling into the same trap, seeing their market share substantially reduced and their services increasingly characterized by obsolescence. And this was just mind-boggling at the time, that these folks were comparing higher education to steel manufacturing and railroads. By the way, Clayton is very comfortable doing this, because he has shown in particular what happened in steel manufacturing and how U.S. United States Steel was put out of business by the Nucors of the world with their fancy mini mill technology. But here's the funny thing. If you had gone out in September of 2006 and bought Union Pacific stock, how do you think you'd have done? Not quite as well as if you had invested in Google. okay? About a 250% return. I did not buy Union Pacific stock in 2006. I wish I had. But go figure. Who'd have thunk? What are, by the way, what forms of competition are the railroads dealing with?
Well, they have worldwide shipping lanes in the ocean, and then they also, on the ground, they have trucking industries.
Yeah. So you've got these huge cargo vessels, right? I mean, giant boats getting bigger and bigger and bigger thanks to technology. And then you're also dealing with a subsidized interstate highway system. And it seemed pretty safe at the time to say, boy, you could go the way of the railroads. Well, not all railroads went the way they thought. And part of the reason, you can see right there, is the railroads adapted. And for those who can't see my PowerPoint slide, what you've got are these double-decker cargo container carriers that the railroads have come up with. And it took some adaptation, by the way. You got low tunnels to deal with. You need good switching equipment where these things could come into the major rail yards and be changed quite quickly. They had to make some investments. They became much more a technology-driven business, right, to really track these things well. But it turns out that it's pretty expensive to go out and lay rail lines. And they don't age that much, right? It's very, very hard to get railroad right-of-ways. Those don't age at all. So they had some great fundamental assets to begin with, and they figured out how to partner up with some of their very competitors because they do some things really, really well. Land bridges. They specialize in land bridges. Now, they're not going to compete with the over-the-road carrier who's doing short distances. But if you want to go from San Francisco to New York, they beat the over-the-road carrier, and they beat the ship that's got to go through the Panama Canal. So there was a place for them. Now, that's kind of... I don't know. I'm not watching the time. I'm having so much fun. I probably need to move us along. Well, let's do this. Let's just pick a couple of other industries where the old names, the old famous names, are still the famous names today. Yes?
Like movie studios like Walt Disney and Paramount and...
Disney's Universal. Disney. And by the way, not only in their film business, but how about their theme parks? I have young sons. I have been to Disney World for the last two Februaries. I didn't go this February. I'm kind of in the doghouse. But we keep going to Disney, and it changes a little. I mean, I no longer need the maps at Disney World. I don't need the maps at Tokyo Disneyland. We lived there long enough. We've done it and done it and done it, and I do not think Walt Disney is likely to be disrupted anytime soon in those theme parks. Why? What is it about, or in the case of their movies, what is it they got? And think theme parks, by the way. Because here's a question. In what ways are universities kind of like theme parks? Brand. The brand matters, right? My kids have heard of Disney. Somebody could go, and by the way, it's related to their movies. There could be a park out there. You and I could go. We could go create a fabulous park. We could spend more money than Disney spent. And my kids wouldn't want to go. And part of the reason is brand. Brand actually matters. What else is it about theme parks that make them hard to disrupt?
Attractions.
And to explain, what is it about attractions? Why couldn't I attract you with an online game?
Well, you have the latest and greatest, so you have to adapt.
Yeah, and it's a physical experience, right? I mean, I couldn't sell my kids on a virtual roller coaster. I couldn't sell them on a theme park with a different brand. I couldn't sell them on a purely virtual experience. They want to be there. I definitely couldn't sell their mother on it, because she's not interested in the roller coaster. But all photos with the characters, you know, the Photoshop alternative to that doesn't work. Yeah.
I think it's that visceral sensory experience, you know, where you engage the senses, you engage not only an application of what you're doing, but even working in a community of people, and that's, you know, a vastly different experience.
Yeah, yeah. So there's something then about brand. There's something about place where being there really matters, and places are hard to turn into bits and bytes and put on the internet and send around the world. Yes?
There's also something about expectations. Like, for example, if you go out and hike the Grand Canyon, there's the expectation that there'll be difficulty, but there'll be rewards. And the theme park is very attractive because the expectation is there's just pure pleasure. You just and everything's taken care of for you, and you don't even have to really work for it.
And, okay, this is great. So for those who couldn't hear with the recording, the idea that expectation... No, but he does need the mic because I'm going to ask a follow-up question. So they set expectations well, and they take care of you. They make sure that you are almost always going to meet those expectations. Okay? It rains. It's going to be a little bit tougher experience, but they're prepared for that. They've got alternatives. Let's suppose you're a first-time user, right? You've never been to Disneyland. You can actually have as much fun the first time as you would the second, third, or fourth time. They're helping you meet your expectations. So what do you think that means for higher education?
Well, one thing is I'm a professor, and I do a lot of instruction. And if I want to lose popularity or have no one be interested in my class or what I'm teaching or be viewed kind of negatively, all I've got to do is say, listen, I want to let everyone know that at the beginning of this class, learning is going to be challenging and difficult. And there's going to be some times that you're going to suffer a little bit because it'll involve, you know, spending some hours working on this, and you might not succeed on everything you do. That's not very good if you think about students as consumers and wanting stuff now. So I think that's an issue that the instructor thinks about.
It's true, but keep the mic, because okay. I think there's another edge to that sword. And it's the one for me that cuts in a direction I like. Because you're right, absolutely. There's a risk that students want to be spoon-fed. I mean, to really press the Disneyland analogy, it would be like, my kids want to go to Disneyland, but they don't actually want to ride the rides. It's weird that way, right? We pay for something we're happy to get less of in higher education. But I want to contrast that with my experience with MOOCs. I'm a MOOC dropout. You know that dream you have? I hope you have it. I have it all my life. You're enrolled in a class you've forgotten about. Right? The exam's coming up, and you're not prepared. Or worse, now when you get old, by the way, it never ends. When you get old, you dream that there are courses in high school you never finished, and now all subsequent degrees are invalid because of that. I have that nightmare. And there are other people here in the room who have that nightmare. I'm living that nightmare in the MOOCs, right? I get in there, I drop out, I can't hack it. The yield rate, I'm not the only one. It's about 90% of the people who sign up are dropping out. So it's true that you could turn me off if you make it sound too much like Paris Island. You know, it's the Marines, the few, the proud. You know, who's am I really going to make it?
Paper chase.
Yeah, you could exactly. Kingsfield. Makes me feel old. But you should definitely go watch. That's a great, great movie, especially if you're going to law school. You must watch The Paper Chase. But so there's that side of it. But on the other hand, I take enough MOOCs, and frankly, I'd rather be in your class where I can talk to you, you maybe care about me, and maybe I find out, I hope I find out, I think I would, that you've been thoughtful about what I'm capable of. For me, that's part of what I think cuts the other direction for higher education in terms of its disruptibility. I don't know what you think about that.
I agree. In fact, one of the things that's useful that I hope never gets taken away are the teacher evaluations and the mid-year evaluations, and I actually think that students should rate their teachers in the public schools just like they do in higher education, because that feedback is really valuable, and I'm not sure how it occurs in the MOOCs, because I also get disappointed when I see things and say, well, you know, maybe I better approach things differently, because that feedback loop, if it's absent, it's hard to adjust your level of instruction to the learner.
Yeah, yeah. But see, just by what you've said, it makes me want to take a class from you. It makes me say, I would pay more, actually. I don't know how much more, but I would pay more if I had someone like you. In the same way, look, I pay a lot at Disneyland. It just stuns me how much I pay. But what I'm paying for is guidance, a certain level of surety, that if I put in a certain effort, I do my part, I know the return's going to be there. So, I don't know about you, but this kind of analysis leaves me thinking, it depends. It depends in higher education on at least two things. And the question, is how much disruption, how quickly? One of the things it depends on is to say, well, what aspect of higher education are you talking about? Because universities and colleges provide lots of services. Even within a particular course, there are lots of functions being performed on my behalf. Some of those functions are probably going to be more disruptible than others. And then the other sense in which it depends is, how quickly do colleges and universities, and especially their faculty, do this kind of analysis and make the decision to respond? Okay, and I'm going to give you one more way of thinking about this. Take you all the way back. I love to learn from analogies. Here's an analogy from the world of computer manufacturing. There was, in the 1970s, a Taiwanese entrepreneur named Stan Shih, he's still alive, who came up with the idea of creating Apple II clones. Now, you have to be very old to remember what the Apple II was. Frankly, I barely remember it. I saw it in the high schools as I was going through, and it was really just a device, almost a toy, more than a computer. But very affordable. It's the first time high schools could really afford computers. Stan Shih said, hey, I'm going to get into the business of making Apple clones. I'm going to be able to sell these machines, even though I won't have the nice brand name, I'll be able to sell them much less expensively for a number of reasons. One is I won't pay to create a good brand name. Acer was the name of his company. I won't care. I won't have the brand. I won't have cutting-edge technology. I'll just copy what they've done. It'll be a clone. And I won't provide any kind of after-sales service or support. You're just going to buy this. There's going to be a way to communicate. In fact, I don't even know before the internet. I'm not sure how he was doing the marketing, but there would be no physical. There certainly wouldn't be any Apple stores. There would be no physical distribution, but you would be able to get this machine so inexpensively that you might say, "Look, I don't care what the name on the box is. I don't care about the absence of service. This is a great deal for me. I couldn't afford it otherwise." This is Clayton's view of the way disruption happens. And sure enough, Stan Shih, because Taiwanese labor costs were lower and he was very, very focused, he came in and did very well. But then he noticed something. And what he noticed, he recognized as being what he called a smiling curve. It didn't make him smile. What he found was that if all you're doing is the stuff in the middle of what we call the value creation chain, which starts up here with an idea for a product, the research that would go into, say, a computer, turning that into a product, building a brand, then going out getting the materials you need to build the machine, making the machine, distributing it, down through to getting it into the hands of the customer and maybe servicing it after it's in the hands of the customer. What Stan found is that there's tremendous downward pressure in the middle of that process because it doesn't take that much human judgment. All right, the manufacturing especially can be automated and or put in the hands of people who are willing to work for low wages. Well, what happened is he began to find that over time, Taiwanese labor rates rose above Chinese and Vietnamese labor rates. And so he was getting squeezed in the very way he'd been squeezing Apple. And he decided, we got to get out of this part of the smiling curve that you don't like, where you're not adding a lot of human judgment. There's not a lot of value added. These things, this is valuable, but it's not very hard to create because it's automatable. And so he said, we got to get upstream into the business of really building our brand, making people care about the quality that's inherent in what we do, believing there's something to be had here. Get into some differentiated products. Our machines will be slightly different than others. And then we'll get downstream into providing things to users after they own the box. We'll help them fix it. We'll stay in touch with them. We'll connect them to peripheral devices, etc. And he became quite successful in doing this. It was in recognition of, hey, not everything we do is of equal value. We got to think about not only what it costs us to do something, but what kind of return we can expect, especially the extent to which, because this is complex and it requires human intelligence, hard to automate, we'll be able to command a greater profit for that. Yes, go ahead. No, it's a great point. This is not value. Karl Marx would say this is not value in use. This is value in exchange. Okay, so it's very, very valuable, right? The fact of the matter is, this is mostly what I want. I want the computer to compute. So there's a lot of value there, but not a lot of value in exchange, because that can be your competition can come in and do that pretty effectively. If they don't have to do the things upstream and downstream. That's what Stan learned. Yes?
So I had a question when I see this curve, and especially with regards to higher education. If I understand correctly, opening a massive online open course, MOOC, gives the university an opportunity to increase its research and branding beyond the typical brochure which is outside its department office about its courses and helps it significantly. Any thoughts on that?
That's a good question. Okay. In fact, you've taken me to my next slide. I'm going to now put all of this up at once. We don't have time to walk through it. But this is what computer programmers, by the way, would call a kludge. I'm force-fitting this to higher education because I want to learn something about it. So forgive me in that. But I think you can make an argument that universities are in some ways similar. That up front, there's this intellectual activity. We call it scholarship in universities. Technically, all the courses that you and I are taking should flow out of things that have been discovered at universities, and they have. Okay. Now, whether there's a tight pipeline between the research in the laboratories up here and all of the courses on the campus, that's a different question. But you can see that universities have got this kind of value creation chain, if you will. They engage in scholarship. They go out and get accreditation, which is an intellectually sophisticated activity that the faculty have to spend more time in than they'd like, but it's valuable. They go out and find good students. They have to develop degree programs and courses. Then they have to convey information and test to see that you've assimilated that information. And ideally, they'll engage in things outside of the classroom that may include tutoring, giving you that degree, certifying the whole bundle of what you've got, the registrar's office. And again, the faculty work very carefully to see that you don't just have a collection of unrelated courses. You've got something that fits together well. The university is hopefully going to provide you a network, give you socializing experience, and especially mentoring with great faculty who want to take time for you as an individual. Yes, there's a comment here.
So, I don't know, I guess the suspense is killing me.
Okay.
And I apologize if I'm jumping ahead here, but if universities are adapting or they take the information and make it broadly available at a very low margin, is there going to be enough room in the world for the amount of information at such a cheap cost?
So that I'm glad the suspense was killing you, and I'm going to jump ahead and try to answer that question.
You don't have to if you're getting there.
Because I think this is where we ought to go. What seems to be happening now? And again, I'm just guessing. I'm trying to make sense of this because I will take you all the way to the end of the movie. And here's the spoiler. I still want to send my kids to a campus like this one. Now, I got a challenge because I've got a daughter, Sarah, who's about to graduate from BYU, Idaho. And she's telling me she's now indifferent between the face-to-face and the online courses. So she takes the one that works best with her schedule, frankly, unless there's a great professor. And I think that's probably in the future. But I don't want to give Sarah, or better yet, Matthew and Spencer, who are ages 8 and 11, I don't want to send them to edX for their whole education. Not even edX and Salcon and Coursera all put together. I want them to come to a place like this. But it would appear that if places like this are going to survive financially, They got to think a bit about what they do that has great value in exchange relative to just great value in use. Because probably we're going to see students saying, you know, I like Sarah's doing. If there's a fabulous professor, or if there's a class which requires me to meet rather than three times a week, one time. And I have this really super experience with a professor, probably in not a very large group. Maybe something like this, you know, where the professor is going to come in and we're going to talk together in sort of a Socratic way. Well, I really, really want that. But I also want the benefit of what else is out there. I'd like my Salcon tutorials as well. I like them partly because they're free, but also partly because I can stop and start them, right? I can go back. I can play them. I don't know if this is true in Khan Academy, but I know it's true in one of the Coursera MOOCs I took. I can not only stop and start the video of Andrew Ng, who's the founder of Coursera, and I can play him. When I play him the second time, I can play it at 1.25 speed or 1.5 speed or 1.75 speed. He's hard to understand. But I control that. And so I think if I'm a student, I want the best of both of those. I want to have really exciting Socratic dialogues. But I also want stuff that is technologically advanced so that I can control it and it doesn't cost me as much. Yes, there's a question in the back.
I think one of the things that I've been waiting to hear during the this week of forums is that as a systems administrator for the university and a full-time student, I have a unique perspective because not only do I spend a lot of time on campus, but I also spend a lot of time in classrooms. We as IT guys and those who support the back end of the education environment here at the university can recommend everything that we could possibly think of to become more agile in stuff like with the Khan Academy, which I've used personally to pass classes. But how do you get tenure-track professors to buy into technology where they don't see it as a threat to their job, where they're going to be marginalized, but as a benefit for their students? I guess that'd be my question.
I think you've asked one of the most important questions that you could ask if you're wondering about the future of traditional colleges and universities. Because the faculty are truly the heart and soul of the institution in two ways. One is they make the important decisions about what you need to know. And we want them to do that, by the way. They can see the long view. They will help you appreciate the humanities. They will help you appreciate the difficult. They will take you more deeply into the mathematics than you might be inclined to go. They see the value of that. So that's one reason we want the faculty to be at the heart of the institution. The other is we've got to recognize that they have control de facto. And there is a risk that at some schools, faculty senates will forestall change. And so as we attempt to engage them, we really need to have an answer to this question, which is to say, what is the role for the full-time faculty? I'll give you my answer. I've kind of been giving it to you, which is to say, look, all of the things that changed my life in college that I can see, by the way, I couldn't see it at the time. I'm just about 50. I'm just about starting to understand what was valuable, really valuable. It's all connected to people. Less to courses. I mean, obviously, there's a correlation between the people and the courses, but not a tight correlation necessarily to the classroom or to the assignments. There are people who changed my life. I want that. I don't want to let go of it. I don't want my children to live in a world. I could handle it, right? If you told me right now I needed to go get a bachelor's degree, I could do that entirely online. But I couldn't do it without having had that experience of being mentored. So my hope is that what we're going to see is a way for that experience to become the core, the essence of what the faculty do. That we use technology to take certain functions around just the pure information sharing, for instance, and the pure testing and certifying. And we say, fabulous. Let's use technology to do that. Let's even outsource it. Right? Happy to have Khan Academy do that part of it for me. I then, as a full-time faculty member, will have more time to focus on the really high value-added functions. And because I have more time, I could serve more students that way. This only works, by the way, it only works if you see the need for more higher education rather than less in the world. And if you see a lot of people who want higher education and can't get it. And the good news is, that's exactly what we have. And so we need to create a world in which, rather than a campus like this one having, I don't know what you've got, 40,000 students, and they're all yours all the time for all functions. The institution's going to have to say, look, we've got a group of people who can engage in these high value added functions of scholarship, mentoring, of creating a bundle of courses and a brand. I've done enough recruiting in management consulting. I've done a lot of recruiting. Let me tell you, I do not want to have to add up merit badges or whatever they're going to call these things and certificates and say that's a well-educated person. I want an institution I trust to do that for me. So these functions, I think, are very not only valuable in use, but valuable in exchange because they're hard to automate. And so for me, the answer for universities such as this one is figure out how to spend more time in the high value-added functions, serve more students, and you're going to be thrilled that you have competitors, so to speak, in the same way that Union Pacific is awfully glad there are big boats out there bringing cargo containers to the point where you're best at what you do.
Your point earlier about analogies, I can't think of any better analogy than a revolution I lived through in my first career in healthcare. I remember a model where you had you had independent physicians and community-based hospitals. That was it. You had your family doctor. Everybody wanted that. And in 30 years or 40, these kids won't remember this, we have giant healthcare delivery systems. And the physicians who put their head in the sand said, it'll never happen. I don't want to be part of a network. It took a generation for that group to basically retire. They thought WebMD was going to take the place of physicians. They thought Doc in the Box, your 24-hour
great analogy,
was
going
to take the place of physicians. And what happened is that physicians sorted themselves out. So you have doctors who want that kind of delivery, who don't want to be on call 24 hours a day, and they found a place in what emerged for where they wanted to be. We still need physicians. They are still at the heart of it. And I think the same thing will happen to faculty, that through a generation, they'll sort themselves out in terms of what part of the instructional delivery model that will emerge.
I really agree with that. And I think it will be a more enjoyable future for those faculty. Although between here and there, bumps in the road, probably. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
We can't hear you on the radio.
Oh, it's my fault.
It's okay. This is
I mean, I have been a faculty member for a couple of decades, and I teach a class that's about this size, a little bit smaller. But I do think that when you're talking about this knowledge piece and the faculty piece and how the faculty's role, at least in a Research One institution, or at least one that I'm familiar with at the University of Utah, I like to think, too, about the concept of the faculty member kind of being in part of this incubator of self-worth. And just a nice example of this is that, and it's hard to disengage this the content from the process.
Yeah.
So, for example, just to give an example to kind of highlight this notion, I'm teaching a class, gave a test, okay? The test comes back. This is the content. Student comes up afterwards and says, look, professor, I didn't do as well as I wanted to on this, and I'd like to see if you could give me some extra credit. And then I said, I reassured the student and said, you know, you've done well. I don't think you need extra credit. So then that's the end of that conversation for a moment, but it goes with me. She goes away thinking, well, I'm not sure I was heard. I go away thinking I've tried to reassure her, but then the week goes on. The next class, I come up and say, look, I think what you're trying to say is you feel like you've been inadequate here, but you've really done a nice job. So this concept of parenting, mentoring, and I'm going to bring it down towards the self-worth piece. Can MOOCs give us self-worth? And what aspect of that are we going to value in a research institution? I mean, on the networking or the mentoring maybe at the end, but it's a little bit more broad than that.
Yeah. I'll just give you my answer, having done some MOOCs and done some face-to-face things. Here's what's cool about the MOOCs. I love, this was just Andrew Ng's machine learning course, which, as I said, I failed to complete. I loved it. They have quizzes, okay? They have quizzes. You can take them up to 100 times. And they're changed just enough that they aren't tests of knowledge. They are learning exercises. In other words, I don't know about you, but I used to think I go to the testing center at the last possible moment, right? When is the absolute deadline? When does the testing center close? I don't want to show up and be tested on what I know before I know everything I want to know. This is the inverse. First thing I do after I watch an Andrew Ng video, I go take the quiz and find out what I don't know. And I can do this with the machine is very, very patient. I can do this time and time and time again with enough modification that I can't just remember the answer to particular questions. And so the testing drives my learning. I love that. And it's free for Andrew. And then let's suppose I were really signed up for one of Andrew's courses. By the way, fascinating thing about this, this is the same course that Stanford students pay for. They're not very happy about that. But let's suppose that I could then go to him or to you. Imagine a student coming to you having had that kind of learning experience at no expense to you. Think of the self-worth that you can now create, the guidance that you, the sort of supporting infrastructure on which you can stand as you mentor that student. To me, I see a kind of best of both worlds that is very, very exciting, much higher quality, and much more affordable and accessible. Now, I don't know if that answered your question. Yeah. So,
machine learning strategy.
I'll try to state what you did, and that is there does have to be now this orchestration, which the faculty member says, look, I know what's happening. It's like the doctor, right? I'm not there in preparation for the surgery, but I'm on a team. I know what they're doing. I know they're getting the prep right. There are going to be surprises in the operating room. But we've choreographed this well enough, we've worked together well enough to know that our expectations are realistic. And then you have the potential to become a surgeon in the lives of these people. And yes, it is about the content, but it becomes much more transcendent than that because you're really shaping the individual. And then there's not a MOOC that competes with that. If I'm an adult and I take a MOOC, I can sort of operate on myself, right? It's okay that all I'm learning is machine learning because I've had as a young person experiences with people like you who've helped me with self-awareness, who've helped me reflect. I flunked out of machine learning, or at least I failed to finish, but I actually was able to critique it. I actually can see the limitations of the modeling that they're doing and saying, you know, at the end of the day, it's very, very fancy mathematics, but some of the judgments they're making, you know, how much would this house sell for? They can give you 20 variables and a zillion houses that have sold, and then you plug in your variables, and that the machine's going to tell you how much your house will sell for. Well, I'm smart enough to know that, look, buying a house isn't just about all the variables. There's a gestalt. There's something about this. I want this house. So somebody once taught me well enough, and it wasn't in a math class, that I could say, hey, that mathematics is really, really cool, but it's got limitations. I'm capable of doing that because I had professors like you.
Wouldn't you say, this is just kind of an overgeneralized comment, but aren't you describing what might just be a great GRE preparatory course?
You know, where you have lots of questions and you've had some previous learning and the questions are actually instruction and curriculum.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a great point to think then about different types of learning, different stages of learning, and what are the tools most appropriate to each of those. I've just seen a 1 minute sign. I just want to close by thanking you for your attention. Expressing confidence about you and this institution. I have a little bias. There is a Henry Eyring Chemistry Building on this campus. I haven't been here in many years. I'm impressed at the growth. I knew a great deal about what you're doing. Michael Young is a dear friend, a fellow SkyWest board member. I'm aware of remarkable stuff happening. The new ideas that are being turned into new companies, the way students are involved. I think this campus is a winner and will be in the future precisely because there's an innovative attitude here and openness to the ideas that we've been talking about that I think will set it apart from other institutions, and I'm going to be cheering for you as that happens.
Please join me in thanking Mr. Eyring for an excellent forum.